content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another episode of Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Recently, the New York Times announced it would suspend some of its regular travel columns and features. This as travel and travel planning are being disrupted by the worldwide spread of the coronavirus. Armchair Traveler likewise went on hiatus as we suspended the recording of new episodes while our offices were temporarily closed to help prevent the spread of COVID-19 among our staff and many volunteers. This week we began recording new episodes as we observe a limited reopening of our studios. On today's episode, we look at how the coronavirus is affecting travel at the moment. First, we read a May 7th, 2020 update of Tururo Mizawa's New York Times article, Three Baltic States Announced a Travel Bubble. What is it, and could it work in the U.S.? Reporter Karen Swartz also contributed to this story. The subhead reads, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania announced a plan to allow for internal travel, and Australia and New Zealand are likely to follow suit. But in other parts of the world, establishing such a bubble would be tricky. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania plan to open their internal borders for citizens to travel between the three countries beginning on May 15th, a decision that creates the first travel bubble among European Union countries as coronavirus-related travel restrictions begin to ease. The announcement, made by the prime ministers of the three Baltic nations, follows a statement made in late April by the prime ministers of Australia and New Zealand, who agreed this week to establish a similar bubble when flights between the countries can be safely arranged. And that was the week of May 6, by the way. Both Australia and New Zealand, compared to other nations, have made significant progress in containing the coronavirus outbreak within their borders. People traveling to the Baltic corridor from other countries will continue to be required to go into isolation for 14 days after entry. It's a big step towards life as normal, says Jüri Ratas, the Prime Minister of Estonia, in a Twitter message. Regional bubbles among a group of states, for example, could be a way to get people traveling again and help revive businesses as the world readjusts to life with the coronavirus. Earlier in the pandemic, the governors of California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, and Colorado said they will coordinate the reopening of their states to limit the spread of COVID-19. A travel bubble among those states might make it easier for residents to travel and work across their borders, though spokesmen for the governors of California, Oregon, and Washington said that they have not yet discussed creating such a bubble. Are travel bubbles legal? Travel bubbles imposed by nations, where strict immigration rules can dictate who enters and exits, are one thing, but would they be legal within the United States? Maybe not. If any states created a bubble to keep out residents of disfavored states, the action would be open to challenge that the bubble violated U.S. constitutional principles of equal treatment, said Cam Winton, a lawyer with the firm Dorsey & Whitney, who has been advising people dealing with state-imposed coronavirus rules. Those principles are enshrined in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, and the so-called Dormant Commerce Clause, which prohibits states from putting undue burdens on interstate commerce, he said. Under its police power, a state can deploy non-discriminatory public health measures while taking the temperatures of everyone entering the state or requiring them to go into quarantine, so long as it imposes that rule on every person, regardless of where the person is from. Mr. Winton added that neighboring states could enter into agreements for coordination of checkpoints, sharing data, and other anti-coronavirus efforts, but those initiatives would all be subject to the constraints on government power conferred by constitutional rights. In the United States, measures created by some municipalities in recent months have created de facto bubbles, but the porousness of these varies from place to place and would be difficult, if not impossible, to make official without infringing upon the rights of states and citizens, experts said. the Key West example. In Florida, the Keys have become their own bubble. Since March 22nd, Monroe County, which includes the islands, has had two checkpoints at the top of the Florida Keys Overseas Highway, one at mile marker 112.5 on the 18-mile stretch of US 1, and the other on County Road 905. Only people who can prove that they live or own property or work in the Keys have been allowed onto the chain of islands that is about 60 miles away from Miami. When Key West, the seat of Monroe County, began reopening its beaches and parks on May 4th for locals, people from neighboring Miami-Dade County tried to drive to the beach but were turned away at the checkpoints. Historically, we've had day trippers come then leave, but Miami-Dade County is a hot spot with a lion's share of cases, so what we're trying to do is only allow essential services into the Keys and say that the beach is open only for locals to get out a few hours a day to get some sun, said Terry Johnston, the mayor of Key West. Our residents want to know that we aren't relaxing orders in a way that would bring visitors to our island until it is safe for that. Officials in Key West have been in conversation with business owners, realtors, and the administrators of attractions like museums about a phased reopening of the city in which everything would reopen to locals first, said Allison Crean, a public information officer. Everyone agrees that opening up to visitors is the last phase, Ms. Crean said. Where does one bubble end and the other begin? Well, for places without the natural geography to help create a bubble, things get murkier. Under Colorado's new Safer at Home policy, people have been ordered by Governor Jared Polis to limit recreational travel to no more than 10 miles from their homes and to try to keep essential travel within their county if possible. Theoretically, those orders would create bubbles that would prevent visitors from traveling to the state's more isolated areas. However, Estes Park, a tourist town in Larimer County that is the gateway to Rocky Mountain National Park and 30 miles from the nearest city, recently began allowing its hotels and short-term rentals to reopen with social distancing policies in place. Kate Rush, a spokeswoman for the town of Estes Park, said that essential travelers and people traveling within Larimer County might need accommodations and that the town wanted to be ready for when travel restrictions were loosened further. But some saw the move as an open invitation to visit. Hattie Serrano, a local resident, wrote in a tweet that hundreds of people had been visiting even during the shelter-in-place order. Telling people to stay home and then opening hotels at the same time is contradictory to one another. If the hotels are open, they will come. They've come despite them being closed. Reopening them is a terrible mistake, she said. Unlike Stephen Rath, objected to staying within the 10-mile bubble, or rather others like Stephen objected. He tweeted that it would be unconstitutional to prevent him from staying in his second home in Estes, where he normally spends 6 months of the year and pays taxes. He asked, "I'm an Estes Park property owner, so am I an outsider or not a local?" Even islands can struggle with bubbles. In South Carolina, the city of Folly Beach, located on Folly Island just south of Charleston, found itself in conflict with the state's governor when it set up checkpoints on the road leading to the island and banned short-term rentals in March. "By creating the checkpoint, we had essentially created a bubble for our island," said the town's mayor, Tim Goodwin. But under an order from the state's attorney general, officials were forced to lift the restrictions. Mr. Goodwin said people immediately began flooding in. "The day that we did lift a checkpoint, we went from an average of 2,000 cars to an average of 10,000 cars, he said. On Peaks Island, an island in Casco Bay, Maine, that is 15 minutes away from downtown Portland and is only accessible by ferry, residents recently asked city leaders to encourage people to only take essential ferry trips to the island out of fear that the guests could increase the number of cases already recorded. Some locals worry that people will flood back to the island over Memorial Day weekend. It's a very conflicted situation with the community needing the business that comes with visitors, but also needing to prioritize everyone's health, said Randy Schaefer, chair of the Peaks Island Council, which is not a legislative body but an advisory group for the island. People might want something like a bubble, but we don't have the legal power to do that, and it is highly unlikely that we would be able to keep people from coming here, he said. We aren't North Korea, he added. Well, let's see what else is happening. as the coronavirus rapidly spread and filled the headlines during the past few weeks, and we go back to January, some maritime travelers elected to leave their land-based shelters and live aboard their sailboats in the Caribbean. Writer Emily Palmer describes their plight in her story, Moored in a Fragile Paradise, this from the April 17, 2020 issue of the New York Times. Hundreds of boaters stuck in the Caribbean have converged on the U.S. Virgin Islands, but there are fears that their safe haven comes at a cost for residents. Doug Mann thought he would ride out the start of the coronavirus pandemic on his sailboat anchored on the shores of Culebra, an island off the coast of Puerto Rico. With airports closing across the Caribbean and restrictions tightening, the American citizen planned to inch his way closer to the United States mainland ahead of hurricane season. But when he arrived, after a three-day sail through rough waters, local officers told him he had to leave immediately, so he sailed on. As governments across the Caribbean moved to restrict the spread of the coronavirus, closing ports and instituting quarantine rules that vary by island, mariners of all nationalities found themselves unwelcome at port after port. Unable to dock, many have converged on the only available and practical harbor of refuge, the U.S. Virgin Islands. As an American territory without control of its borders, the idyllic islands now have the largest number of boats that local officials have ever seen bobbing off their shores, as many as 600 boats at one point, up from 270 typically moored or anchored there each year. With weather up north still dicey and ports shuttered en route, they have few alternatives. Residents have become increasingly concerned about not only a potential damage to fragile marine ecosystems, but also the water quality and an already limited medical supply. The virus is expected to crest in the territory in May, here for an unknown duration. In an open letter on March 27th, Governor Albert Bryan Jr. welcomed visitors to a safe haven under U.S. flag protection at this grave time. The U.S. Virgin Islands, made up of St. Thomas, St. John, St. Croix, and Water Island, are subject to American laws. Across the territory, yachts of all sizes now crowd-weather the turquoise waters, shoehorned into the curved bays on makeshift moorings. Typically at this time of year, sailors hop port to port across the Caribbean, enjoying the beaches. Now those beaches are closed and mariners are supposed to stay on their boats except for picking up essentials. Everything has converged here all at once, says Jean-Pierre Oriol, commissioner of the territory's Department of Planning and Natural Resources, who has worked there for two decades. I've never seen the volume here in the territory that we have now, he added. At the end of March, New Jersey residents Carol and David Hewitt were on their island packet sailboat about a quarter mile from the Dutch island of St. Eustatius when Miss Hewitt recalled, "We were greeted as we entered their only harbor with bullhorns and boats. They turned around and sailed through the night to the U.S. Virgin Islands. Now moored on St. Francis Bay in St. John, the couple, who are in their 60s, say they do not want to return home. The New York area is now the pandemic's epic center. Like many sailors, they do not want to leave their boats by flying home if they could even get a flight out. Theirs, for later this month, has already been canceled. Their son, based in Midtown, New York, has moved his family, including their infant grandson, into the couple's home, and the Hewitts fear contracting the virus on the plane and passing it along. Many mariners, like the Hewitts, plan to ride out the pandemic on islands, choosing what appears their safest option in an ever-changing set of unknowns. But Marvin A. Blyden, a territory Senate leader who has drafted several pieces of legislation regarding the mariners since their arrival, worries that plain safe haven for guests will prove dangerous for residents. We don't have the resources to deal with the large influx, he said. Yes, we're an American system. Yes, we should look to help those in need. But at the same time, we must protect our borders and we must protect our people. Concerns over water quality. Sailors might seem self-sufficient if they have food, water, and other supplies on board, but waste disposal remains an urgent need. Most big ports include pump-out stations, but St. John's does not, so mariners must trek 3 miles out to sea to dump their waste. Some have not followed the rules. There have been reports of illegal dumping, which could affect the waters across the territory. Just by increasing the volume of boating, you impact the environment as a whole, said Lee Fletcher, president of Ocean Systems Laboratory Incorporated, which conducts water quality testing in the territory. We should be setting up a special program for what is now occurring. Residents are particularly worried about the quality of beach water, which has not been tested since the end of March. Testing in the national park is expected to start within the week, but testing of territorial waters has been suspended indefinitely, pending the local government's payment of an outstanding bill, and that testing, by the way, was due to start in mid-April. And many boats are farther away in areas that are never tested, the lab owner said, making it impossible to know the effects on marine ecosystems. These ecosystems are crucial to two of the territory's most important industries, tourism and fishing. It's a much longer story for us, says Bridget Berry, a St. Thomas resident who helped found the Marine Rebuild Fund to clean the waters after two devastating back-to-back hurricanes in 2017. I remember my dad fishing in that bay. He told me stories about his dad fishing in that bay. I see my nieces playing in that bay. We want generations more to fish and swim in that bay, so we get very protective of that, she said. Though the public beaches have been shuttered, the Natural Resources Department issued an advisory earlier this month warning that compliance with water quality standards for safe swimming or fishing at beaches territory-wide is unknown. Moreover, overboard dumping increases the risk of viral contamination, noted Amy Dempsey, vice president for Ocean Systems. The coronavirus survives in sewage, and she said the effect on saltwater is unclear. Mariners following the rules worry about coming back to a stranger at their mooring ball. Stephen Meister and his family had been moored off St. John for almost a month. They had left their home in Long Island for his daughter's spring break, but are now working, schooling, and in the case of his daughter, Michaela, practicing the violin on their 70-foot yacht. One recent morning, sailing off to dump the waste, Mr. Meister saw a catamaran approaching his dinghy, in which his wife and daughter sat near the mooring ball. The catamaran had its boat hook extended. "They're jousting at my wife like medieval knights," he recalled, "and they're arguing you can't hold the mooring." He quickly returned to claim his place and made the 30-minute journey 8 hours later when the coast was clear, as he puts it. Now to keep track of how many boats are entering the territory and get a better handle on contamination concerns, government officials have reinstituted monthly mooring and anchoring fees, which were temporarily suspended with the outbreak. Since the fees, Mr. Meister confirmed that the mooring ball wars had come to an end. More and more garbage. Some cruisers seeking a more secluded haven away from town have nestled among the tree-sheltered waters of the Virgin Islands National Park, which makes up almost two-thirds of St. John. But with the closure of the park and the halting of garbage collection, bags of trash soon were piled around locked barrels, concerning boaters and residents alike. Some residents banded together, filling a truck bed with trash on a recent weekend. The park also quickly certified several residents who wear masks to help with garbage removal and grocery delivery. Nate Fletcher, a St. John resident and the owner of Blue Line Yacht Charters, which has not had an onboard guest in more than a month, now goes twice a week boat to boat collecting trash. He gathered 60 bags on April 14th. "It's a big career change," Mr. Fletcher said with a laugh, adding that his boat, the Poseidon, a 37-foot Midnight Express with three 300-horsepower engines, is very, very fast trash boat. The $5 a bag charge does not yield a profit, but allows him to stay even with his bills while helping resolve what was quickly becoming a problem, he said. The coronavirus has arrived. To combat the spread of the virus, the U.S. Virgin Islands have instituted shelter-at-home and social distancing measures. Restaurants and bars have closed. Now, the virus arrived in the Virgin Islands in March, and by mid-April, 51 COVID-19 cases were reported and two deaths, with more than a third of the cases coming from tourists or residents traveling within 14 days of displaying symptoms. Local health officials project more than 20,000 infections and upward of 100 hospitalizations if people abide by the strictest measures. But with looser rules, hospitalizations would rocket up to almost 1,000 at any one point in time, Dr. Esther Ellis, the territorial epidemiologist, said by email. The islands do not have the resources to handle such an outbreak. Medical professionals say the two hospitals on St. Thomas and St. Croix are understaffed and together have 20 intensive care unit beds and 127 ventilators. In the hopes of stymieing the spread of the virus, the local government has implemented self-reporting health questionnaire, which boaters must fill out. Homeward Bound. In the crowded Virgin Island harbors, boaters are hearing from other mariners in the Caribbean who feel stranded in more restricted waters. These sailors are asking if they should come to the U.S. Virgin Islands. The governor's office, which lacks the authority to close ports and airports, this would halt food and medical imports, said they would not discourage mariners from coming, but there are strict territory-wide guidelines they should follow when they arrive. Richard Mata, the governor's communications director, added that solely out of the capacity, the office would prefer, if they are to come to the territory, to come to St. Croix, because a lot of the bays have already reached capacity at St. Thomas and St. John. The number of boats remains high, but much of the traffic has halted in recent days, and some boats, between 100 and 150, Mr. Oriel estimates, have already left. Those who are staying indefinitely are up against yet another impending deadline. Hurricane season begins in June. Many boat owners have insurance policies requiring them to leave the Caribbean by June or July. Many would typically hire crew members to help with the journey back, but cannot easily do so under pandemic conditions. One solution is the Homeward Bound Flotilla, an organized departure of boats leaving every Sunday for at least a month. The first 9 boats left on Easter. Salty Dog Sailing Association, a nonprofit which typically organizes social boating trips, has set up resources to help the passage, waiving its typical fees. "We just want it to be as inclusive as possible," said Hank George, the association's president. "We didn't want anyone wandering into the ocean on their own." Mariners joining the flotilla may access a U.S. Coast Guard interface, an online journey tracker, and weather updates. The Salty Dog communicates with authorities and helps troubleshoot closed ports en route. Approximately 160 boats have registered so far. Most are stationed in the territory and will head out over the next month. Other mariners, like the Hewitts, plan to stay put. Mr. Mann, who was turned away at Calibra, says he plans to leave as early as April 20th for the Chesapeake Bay, weather permitting. Wow, some interesting stories because of all this coronavirus. Well, let's close out with something a little different before we end our journey today. We're going to step back to the September 20th, 2019 issue of the Washington Post to hear from writer Richard Morin's article, "At the Large Hadron Collider, A Peek at the Future of Science." We're going to read an excerpt from that article. Physicist Abhijan Desgupta, Reju to his family and friends, looks over his shoulder to caution our 12-member group as we prepare to descend 300 feet beneath the French countryside into the largest machine on Earth, the $4.7 billion Hadron Collider. Big science doesn't get much bigger than the Large Hadron Collider, also called the LHC, on the campus of the European Organization for Nuclear Research, known as CERN. It's a facility outside Geneva. The LHC runs in a circular 16.7-mile underground tunnel that crisscrosses the Swiss and French border. More than 1,200 superconducting magnets, each 50 feet long and weighing 35 tons, and joined end-to-end, make up the collider's ring. Guided by the magnets, trillions of protons circulate at nearly light speed in opposite directions inside a pair of 2-inch diameter tubes. At 4 points along the ring, aiming magnets send the 2 counter-rotating beams crashing into each other. These collisions blast the protons into subatomic smithereens. Detectors weighing thousands of tons, think of them as giant cameras, positioned at the collision points, record 3-dimensional images of each of the 40 million proton mashups that occur every second. Aided by high-speed computers and algorithms of mind-bending complexity, scientists pore over the tracks left by these impacts for clues about the origins of our universe and the existence of extra dimensions, and for undiscovered particles that might usher in a new era of discovery in the physical sciences. Our gateway to the collider is Compact Muon Solenoid, or CMS, on the accelerator ring near Cesse, France, a half-hour car ride from downtown Geneva. The CMS detector is one of 7 experiments on the collider's ring and one of the 3 visitors can tour. We enter a cavernous hangar-like room dominated by a 70-foot-high cross-sectional photograph of the CMS detector deep beneath our feet. When the accelerator is running, we are told this is as close as visitors would get to the CMS. The Large Hadron Collider is in the first months of a two-year technical shutdown for maintenance and upgrades. During that time, visitors lucky enough to secure a place on a CERN-guided tour can go deep underground to visit the cavern that houses the gigantic detectors. When researchers switched the collider back in early 2021, visitors will receive a more limited underground tour until the next two-year stop in 2025. You're extremely lucky, Descupta tells us. If you had come here a year ago, you would not have been able to go down. We round a corner and stop in front of a blocked-off entrance. Descupta steps into something that looks like a yellow phone booth. He looks intently at a retinal scanner on the wall of the booth. The door is closed behind him as another set opens on the other side. It scans my eyes and it lets me in. The rest of you can be cargo and go through the cargo door. Descupta lets us in and we board the freight elevator that will take us 300 feet down to the detector chamber. At the bottom, we pick up orange hard hats fitted with a computer chip so that security can track our precise location. We walk along a passageway, its walls hung with photos of the collider and informational pieces. Descupta, a natural teacher who has just completed his physics PhD at UCLA, switches into data delivery mode. He explains that at full power, a proton makes 11,245 trips around the collider ring every second. Instead of a continuous stream, the protons travel in bunches or packets. Each packet contains 110 billion protons and is spaced 25 nanoseconds apart, an interval of about 25 billionths of a second. Before a proton is annihilated, it will be traveling at 99.999999% of the speed of light, he says. The next 15 minutes pass as a blur. We must hurry. There are other tours behind us. We pass banks of electronic equipment and computers that tower over our heads, all connected by rivers of wires that snake up to the ceiling. It is here, Descupta says, where electronic hardware and computer software winnow the 40 million collisions that occur every second to the 1,000 most interesting ones. These are stored for further analysis. And we scurry through the passageways. Banks of overhead lights illuminate our way past danger warning signs and radiation symbols, and descend steep stairs. Once more, suspended catwalks take us into the underground cavern that houses the CMS. The detector is split horizontally in half like a giant melon. The two halves are pulled apart to allow workers to access the detector's inner workings. They will be inched back together, and the proton beam tubes reunited when the work is complete. It's anything but compact. The detector measures nearly 70 feet long and 50 feet wide, and at 14,000 tons, weighs about twice as much as the Eiffel Tower. It's also beautiful. Concentric rings of gold and candy apple red detectors encircle the proton beam tubes at the center. Lime green supports help hold the electronics in place. Shimmering metal that looks like aluminum foil catches the industrial lights. It could be a space station or a half-billion-dollar piece of art. Well, we've run out of time for our episode of today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you'll listen next time, that you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. We remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138.